Lee Arts, a professor at Purdue University.
I teach media studies at Purdue, and I taught at Loyola. Actually, I had a class here just a couple years ago. I came back, but I taught at Loyola for about 10 years. What we're witnessing now is arguably the worst refugee crisis we've seen since World War II, right? 4 million refugees. It's creating havoc, disrupting the political and cultural life in Europe, but it's much worse for the people in the Mideast because people are dying. It's not just the refugees disrupting the cafes in Bucharest, but it's people die in the Mideast, and especially in Syria at the moment. New York Times reports that 100,000 people have been killed in the civil war. It's arguably the primary humanitarian crisis we're looking at right now. Teaching media and also doing some research in the media, this is very confusing. It's very confusing, it's complex, and one thing I've learned of looking at the media all this time is you can't rely upon the media to tell you what's going on. And sometimes, even when we know that, we don't act that way. Even when we know ABC News or AP, the New York Times, has a particular perspective, just the flood of that information sometimes overwhelms our ability to make some more discerning decisions. And I think that's true in this case. We're being presented with Syria as a site of terrorism, a site of a dictator, but we don't have any context for that. There is no historical context. And we're not going to talk about history, long history today, but I just want to bring a couple things to your attention. Syria was the first independent country in the Mideast after World War II. In 1946, they had a democratic election. They were the first people to elect a democratically elected government. It was a little too left for the U.S., so they were also the first country in the Mideast to be part of a coup that was supported by the U.S. and the CIA in 1949. And then we had 30 years until you get to Assad, who was also a coup. But at this point, I think the context we need to look at is it's one of the few secular states in the Mideast. The other one might be Tunis and Egypt, but they actually have elections. And I don't, it's kind of secondary whether you like Assad or don't like Assad. It's like, did you like George Bush or did you like the Chads, right? Which one did you like? He was a president, and that's kind of where we are. There's no beheadings in Syria. Women can drive a car. Women can wear clothes. They can walk down the street. But what you see in the New York Times is you don't see Damascus or the modern country. You don't see that. You don't get the context. We know there's a humanitarian crisis, and you see pictures of kids and the lack of bandages and lack of medicine and the humanitarian white helmets or blue helmets are bringing medicine. Again, you don't have the context that there is a sanction that's enforced by the U.S. that does not allow medicine into a country where there's health care. And this is in no way to suggest that Assad is somebody that should be supported. That's not the issue. I just suggest that we look at the media and its track record. I ask you to think very quickly through the decades. The Gulf of Tonkin in 1960s. There was no Gulf of Tonkin. The Vietnam War happened, right? In the 1980s, there was this big ship. I remember seeing it on ABC, this ship, and there were tarps over it, and somehow the U.S. knew underneath those tarps were Russian MiGs, which is why there had to be a Contra war in Nicaragua. In the 90s, remember the incubator babies in Kuwait? Which is why the U.S. had to intervene as a humanitarian rescuer of the incubator babies. Or weapons of mass destruction, right? You got to save humanity. Just a few years ago, there were Russian tanks in the Ukraine. No pictures, no evidence. So when they tell us about barrel bombs and bombing hospitals and shooting Red Cross trucks, I'm not saying it's not true, it's not factual, but I suggest you have a healthy dose of skepticism considering the track record. I didn't talk about the 70s because the United States spent that whole decade just overthrowing one country after another because there were commies everywhere. So Commies aren't around anymore. They're all Muslims. But now you can find things outside of the New York Times or ABC News. It's not easy, but you can find that. And I think that we're fortunate that we're going to have our speaker tonight from the U.S. Peace Council. The U.S. Peace Council is a national organization for peace and disarmament, been around for more than 30 years. U.S. Congresswoman Barbara Lee was a member for a while. Illinois Senator Alice Palmer was a member. Gus Newport, mayor in California. But today, more importantly than where it came from, is today they've done us a service, because the U.S. Peace Council got 7 people from the United States, and they got visas from the United States, and they got permission to go to Syria. Lawyer, journalist, professor, union members went to Syria. And who'd they meet with? Aid workers, people that were injured in the war, students, teachers, lawyers, journalists, and here's a thought, the opposition political parties that are elected to the parliament in Syria. Did you know that? Right? So, what they have to say, and I interviewed Joe earlier on a television show today, it's hard to fathom. It's hard to believe. But you have to think carefully about it. The opposition, by the way, is both Muslim and, if you want credibility, I guess, Christian. Right? You've got to throw those people in, too. It's some of the stuff, so I ask you to listen closely. Joe Jameson, who is here tonight to present to us, is on the executive committee of the U.S. Peace Council. He's been active in anti-war movements since Vietnam. He was a conscientious objector during Vietnam. He was on the staff of the New York State AFL-CIO for more than 20 years. He was a journalist for the Transport Workers Union in New York, and he was a journalist for their newspaper, the TW Express. And he was one of the members of the U.S. Peace Council delegation that spent 6 days there. And they reported back to the United Nations in a press conference, and we're fortunate to have Joe here tonight. So I'd ask you to welcome Joe Jameson.
Thank you, Professor Parks, for that very kind introduction. I want to thank Stan Smith, who did all the hard work of organizing this. He's a solidarity activist. He's a. There isn't any branch of suffering humanity that Stan isn't working to liberate. So it's very kind of him to organize this talk on Syria. I want to thank you for coming out on a Tuesday night, because I know you're giving up a really exciting vice presidential debate, which, you know, you're probably all videotaping it just so that you don't miss 1 second of Pence and Kaine battling it out. So I'm going to jump around a bit. I think I'm not going to go more than half an hour. If I do, I'll get the hook from the professor or Stan or somebody. I want to talk about the stakes of the war, the scale of the war, who we were, why we went, facts that undermine the dominant narrative. I'm going to use that phrase, the dominant narrative, conclusions that we drew, and the urgency of this moment. I'm not an expert on Syria. I've studied it both 8 months for 8 months before we went, and then since then, studying things that we wanted to look deeper into. But I am an expert on what we saw and the conclusions that we collectively drew. So I got back on August 1st from an intense week in Syria, and the co-leaders were the fellow who is the vice president of the Veterans for Peace. Two members of the U.S. Peace Council leadership, including myself, an activist from UNAC, which is a fairly well-known anti-war federation, Palestinian American lawyer from New Jersey, a professor of sociology from New Jersey, a woman who's an anti-drone activist from upstate New York, and a Syrian-American community leader who spoke Arabic fluently, which was very useful as an alternative to if we had any question about translation. And what I'm going to do is appeal to you tonight to reject the dominant narrative. And I think you know what it is, but take, for example, what you hear, that this is a civil war. Just to one example. I'll return to this point. It's not a civil war. I mean, we have, that many of us are of a certain age, and so we have some experience under our belt, and we lived through the Reagan's wars in Nicaragua. This is much more like the Contra War in the 1980s against an independent Sandinista government in Nicaragua. You have essentially an externally financed and coordinated external attack by mercenaries. That's what you have in Syria. It is not a civil war. And I'll explain, there are lots of other reasons to at least be skeptical that it's a civil war. In my opinion, it certainly is not. So I'm going to ask you to believe, come to believe the opposite of what you hear every day. And some people are stubborn. They just take their impressions and just run with them. And I'm fond of quoting Mark Twain, who said that it's not what we don't know that gets us into trouble. It's what we think we know for sure that just ain't so. And a lot of our fellow Americans think they know for sure about Syria, and it's getting us into trouble. The scale of the catastrophe of the war, I think the number that I use and that most people use is the UN number, which is 400,000. Killed. 5 million emigrants. Syria has about 21 million people. Half of them have had to move. They've moved largely into the government control areas, which tells you a lot about the nature of the war. They've moved toward eastern Syria, near the coast. So you have all the problems of people doubling up, tripling up, quadrupling up, families crowding together to get away from the jihadi or what they call terrorists. I should deal with that nomenclature issue right up front, because I'm in the habit of calling them mercenaries or foreign fighters or jihadists, but the Syrians simply call them terrorists, and end of discussion. We could hear when we were there, I don't want to dwell on the touristy aspects of this, but we could hear mortar fire. We were in a commercial hotel, a Sheraton, nice Sheraton hotel in western Damascus. We could hear outgoing mortar fire and incoming mortar fire. 8 people were killed in the old city of Damascus when we were there, just by some mortar lobbed on a section of the all the shops they have there. They have what they call souks, which are these large, elongated. Markets, and so they lobbed a bomb on a souk. It was completely random. When we were there, the terrorists lobbed a bomb on the architectural school at Damascus University. We took a day tour outside of Damascus. We saw a Christian village called Malula, which was leveled by the jihadists. It's now being rebuilt. It's a fascinating place. They speak Aramaic there, or the language of Jesus. It's a very fascinating place, but culturally. And the patriarch gave us a tour. And it was leveled and now being rebuilt by the UN and the Syrian government. We visited a convent built by the Emperor Justinian, which had been bombed by the jihadists. So it's a historically rich and beautiful place that is just being wrecked by the war. The dominant narrative, let me return to that. You've heard it, you know it, and I'm going to contest it as much as I can. It is that President Assad is a monster, a madman, a butcher. His government is a brutal, unpopular dictatorship. It is always a regime, always a brutal regime. It's never a government. The fact that he was elected doesn't seem to, and that his government is recognized by the United Nations doesn't seem to disturb the Western media. He and his government and his army are responsible for atrocities against civilians and doctors, especially now that Aleppo is in the news. We're getting a spate of atrocity stories now, and I think there's a reason for that. The reason is the military equation is changing rapidly, and the jihadists are losing the war at the moment. These things can change. And there's a certain desperation and erratic behavior we're seeing both in the media coverage and in the political commentary coming from the Washington establishment. I don't know whether you had a chance to see it, but our UN representative, Samantha Power, who is normally a fairly cool person, did a rant the other day. You can see it on YouTube. It's as if she's becoming incoherent because the news is not good for the White House and the war in Syria. We are told the U.S. is fighting ISIS terrorism. We are told the U.S. is on the side of human rights. We're told it's a civil war. We're told that the U.S. Is supporting and should support the moderate rebels, but it's really waging a war against the really bad guys, ISIS. That's the dominant narrative. And very little of it or none of it is true, I will argue. And that's what our, it's not just me, this is what our delegation concluded. And we were people of different political backgrounds, mostly activists, mostly people on the left, people who care about social justice, but who were skeptical, tough-minded people. And that's what we concluded. So the main conclusion we came when we got back was how the hell are we going to fight the dominant? It's like rolling a boulder up Mount Everest, because every single day, even good channels, like I listen to NPR, I listen to Pacifica. We have a good Pacifica channel in New York. They adopt this language. They adopt these concepts. Amy Goodman, who I have respect for, she ran a story from the jihadi-controlled section of Aleppo, interviewing some guy saying, please, Mr. Obama, do something, children are dying. President Assad is killing the children. You know, it was war propaganda. And yet, Amy Goodman, who is a basically decent person who tries to do the right thing, NPR is even worse. I won't even comment on them. And the corporate media is entirely bad. So how do we begin to, we decided the only way we could begin to undermine is to fight first within the anti-war movement to start to correct the understanding of the nature of the war. Because we have an anti-war movement whose major organizations will only go so far because they partially accept the dominant narrative, or at least consciously or unconsciously. I'm not sure. Who knows what goes on in somebody's consciousness. But they'll say, oh, we're against, we're for aid to the humanitarian aid. We're for decent treatment of the refugees. We're for a ceasefire. That's as far as they go. They won't recognize the nature of the war. And the nature of the war is that U.S., I'm going to use the word imperialism, I won't use it often, but I want to use it because I have a feeling this is an activist group that's probably heard the word before. The U.S. empire wants to eliminate the last standing secular democratic, I'm not going to shy away from that word, state in the Middle East. Its policy existed before the war. It existed before this Assad. It existed under the previous Assad. And it's, in general, it's the policy of the United States toward all Middle Eastern countries. Look out for the oil pipelines. Look out for the interests of Israel. Look out for the overall global strategic equation. And that's why Syria is in the firing line. Even on our trip, we knew we were going to get pushback when we got home. Maybe I'll get some pushback tonight. I don't know. But I'm determined to tell you what we saw. And we got nasty on our Facebook page. I'm not a Facebook person, but the people who are on our group got nasty posts on their Facebook pages, even while they were in Syria for that 1 week. So that's how fast the machine kicked into motion. I want to talk about, I'm going to jump around. I want to talk about Assad demonization. First of all, demonization is a standard technique of U.S. empire. Every person, every government that the U.S. wants to overthrow, it precedes that process by demonizing the leader. And then once it's got U.S. public opinion believing that he's worthless or he's, you know, against his people or bombing his people, whatever particular nature of the demonization, then the troops go in, then the bombs go in, then the war effort begins. And our basic position at the U.S. Peace Council is an anti-imperialist position. We may be unique in that. A lot of other peace organizations arose out of moral protest, religious protest against the horrors of war. Good motives, understandable motives, but not an analysis of what's the real major cause of war in this world we live in. And we say it's imperialism. And we reject Assad demonization. We take no position on the government of Assad. No position. I will, in a moment, comment on how absurd the demonization is on a factual basis. But we, as Americans, have no right to determine who runs the government in Damascus. It's solely a question for the Syrians. It's not the Saudis. It's not the Qataris. It's not the Turks. It's not the Israelis. It's not any of the Gulf monarchies. And it's not Britain and France and the EU powers, who are also contributing to the mayhem. Our solidarity is with the Syrian people. And our job as Democrats, as small-d Democrats, is to stop the empire from crucifying the Syrian people with this war. Because none of the other players are big enough to run this. It's the U.S. that's running the war, although it takes great pains to try to hide that fact. But it is arming the Saudis to the teeth. It is arming the Turks. It trains the Turks. It trains the jihadis in Jordan. It finances the Gulf monarchies. All these secondary players would not be boldly inserting mercenaries into Syria if it were not for the U.S. overarching role. So I think we ought to talk about the nature of the people. There are people who are, oppose this perspective, who are very decent people, decent liberals, decent progressives, and they don't seem to understand the consequence of the policy that they are arguing for. When they argue for regime change, I hate that word, but when they argue for toppling a legitimate government in the Middle East that was elected, they are in effect arguing to put the Wahhabism in power. And let me talk about Wahhabism. It's not a word that, you know, is used every day, but it's the particular reactionary form of Islam that governs the Saudi state. And it is that version of Islam that the Saudis have organized a worldwide recruiting effort to bring armed fighters to Syria. And what kind of a state will they establish if they were to win? Well, it would be like Saudi Arabia. In other words, extremely backward attitudes toward censorship, women, women's rights, brutal punishments, beheadings. That is what Wahhabism is. And the Muslim Brotherhood, which is also very powerful in the picture, is almost as strong. But the Wahhabism is probably the dominant ideology of the jihadists. I have a lot of stuff on the independence of our trip and how carefully. Let me just go through a couple of things. Much of the war against ISIS, which you hear so much about, is faked. The U.S. is not really trying to crush ISIS. ISIS serves a very useful political role because images have been implanted into the American public's mind, the beheadings, some of the awful things that ISIS has done, blowing up ancient monuments and terrorizing both Muslim and Christian communities. The U.S. essentially is giving ISIS a free pass, maintaining a rhetorical denunciation of it, but encouraging it to fight the government. That's the role of ISIS. The other thing the U.S. is doing is maintain, and this we learned this when we got there. I didn't know much about the sanctions. The U.S. sanctions against Syria are almost as bad as the Iraq sanctions. We met with the business community, and as sort of a lifelong trade unionist and socialist, I don't often meet with the Chamber of Commerce, but I met with the Chamber of Commerce of Damascus, and they were talking about their inability to get spare parts to keep the industry going. They were talking about the lack of vaccines, the lack of medicines for children, the lack of hospital equipment and hospital technology. The U.S. is trying to shut down the Syrian economy bit by bit. We also met with the lawyers. This affects travel restrictions and sanctions affect all across Syrian society. They've successfully isolated Syria, and the head of the Damascus Bar Association told us that he has law cases that he wants to prosecute in Geneva and in various international venues where lawyers take human rights cases, and he can't do it because he can't get out of the country. He can't even pay for an airplane ticket for a Syrian lawyer to go to the International Criminal Court or to the International Court of Justice in The Hague. So let me get back to this question of the dominant narrative. I want to talk about why it's... We had a meeting with Assad, But I am I really don't like to talk about it much because, A, he didn't say anything that was very new and that we didn't hear from other officials or other civil society groups. And B, it changes the terrain because the people who support the war with left-wing reasons for some, or right-wing reasons because they support the empire, prefer to keep it a discussion about Mr. Assad and his policies. We met his opposition both on the left and on the right, which is critical of him, but some of whom are in the government. For example, the Minister of Reconciliation, a man named Ali Haider, we met with him twice. He runs the reconciliation program, which amounts to an offer on the part of the Syrian government. If the jihadis will lay down their arms, they can be reintegrated. If they're Syrian, they can be reintegrated into Syrian society. Who knows about that in the United States? We didn't know it before we went. We studied up on it. It's a military policy. It's related to a military policy, but essentially it's a restorative justice program that is quite advanced and quite unique in the world. I'm not aware of any other country facing an external invasion that has that kind of a program. And we were told it's about 70% effective. So that's a significant fact. But when we spoke to him, we asked, how do you work with a government that is, he represents the second largest party after the Ba'ath party, Assad's party, and Socialist party. He says his party was critical of some of the concessions to neoliberalism and, you know, the IMF and the World Bank and these big financial institutions that Syria made concessions to. So they would be critical of that. But that de facto, since 2011, the current government is a symbol of national unity. It is, in effect, a national unity government, and it enjoys the support of the vast majority of Syrians. So it is not a civil war at all. It's a war of aggression against an independent Syrian state externally financed by Saudis and Qataris. It's supported by the Turks and the Israelis and the Jordanians, but it's primarily at the instigation and organization of the United States and the European Union. So let me conclude. The U.S. We need a peace movement that begins to talk about this and not nibble around at the edges about, you know, be nice to. It's important that the Syrian refugees be treated humanely, and God knows they're not being treated humanely. But the stakes are actually larger than that. It's not just the humanity. It's a world war crisis, in effect, because the people, let's say, around the Democratic candidate for president who are calling for no-fly zone, I don't think they seem to know what a no-fly zone is. A no-fly zone is an air war. It means U.S. jets knocking Russian and Syrian jets out of the sky. Now, last I heard, Russia is a nuclear-armed state. So if you want a U.S. nuclear-armed state having an air war over Syria with another nuclear-armed state, then support a no-fly zone. It's insane. And there are some voices around the Democratic candidate who talk for boots on the ground, in other words, direct invasion. I have my own impression that very much the current U.S. administration's policy is wait for Hillary. Don't do anything that causes us to lose the war between now and January. Wait for Hillary. I think that's the policy. It explains some of the thrashing around you see in U.S. government circles about what to do now. What are the options? The options are getting. It looks to me like, honest to God, I'm afraid to say this, but it looks like a pre-World War situation. It looks so much like a pre-World War situation. The U.S. and the Russians, after having cobbled together some, I think, semi-phony ceasefires, are now talking about, they don't discuss anything anymore. Lavrov is not talking to Kerry. So diplomatic relations on Syria have broken down completely. So that's the dangerous moment we are in. We've got an American election where no matter what happens, we're going to have a more hawkish president. And what the Republican candidate believes, who knows? I think he's threatened to nuke the place. I don't know what he's said, but it's a terrible situation where two such hawks are likely to occupy the White House. I'm probably a pretty severe critic of Mr. Obama, but I will say he's exercised some restraint on at least some occasions, and that's not likely to continue if after January. The U.S. anti-war movement has certain tasks. We have got to shift the perspective of the anti-war movement and stop the nibbling Casper milquetoast policy and go after the main thing, which is the U.S. policy of regime change. That has to end, and it has to be demanded that it end. It's not now being demanded, except by a few small peace groups like ours. That has to be demanded. So we have to overcome our present confusion. I think our humble U.S. Peace Council delegation had some good effect, because it's broken open a discussion which we should have had a long time ago. So that's a step forward. Keeping the Assad demonization going full blast guarantees a tame, silent anti-war movement and a tame, silent U.S. public opinion. Between now and January, we have to do everything we can to ramp up opposition to the regime change policy and change the basic perspective. So I have asked you to reject the dominant narrative. It influences all of us and influences me. I was referring to the Syrian regime the other day instead of the normal word, Syrian government. And if we do that, we have a chance. Thank you.
I wanted to announce the sponsors for the event, which includes the Loyola University Department of Sociology, the Chicago Albus Solidarity Committee, at the Veterans for Peace in Chicago. And we should thank those groups for making this possible. Of course, the U.S. Peace Council and Joe. The Anti-War Committee. Thank you. We have a little bit more than an hour before we have to leave the room, but that's some time, and then if people would like to stay and talk, we can do that, I'm sure, downstairs in the lobby or elsewhere. So I understand this is a controversial topic, and there will be some passions, and if you're not passionate about something, shame on you. So I appreciate the passion. I just think we should see as our goal is to gain an understanding collectively, to clarify questions that we have or points of view that we have. And I'm going to ask everyone to keep their remarks or questions to 3 minutes. Right. And I would really encourage you to go on the U.S. Peace Council website. The first thing I saw was their press conference at the United Nations, where six people, not everybody was there, five people from the delegation gave reports, and there was a couple women, and like I said, he didn't talk much about some of the journalists and some of the others, but that's okay. Okay, yes, sir, way back.
Become a war resister after 9/11. I saw that the U.S. was in Afghanistan only to draw the Taliban back into the fight. I signed up to prevent another terrorist attack and realized my actions in Afghanistan were only creating the conditions for more terrorist attacks. Since coming back to Chicago, I've been on a mission with Veterans for Peace to go into the schools, to talk about the JROTC programs in the schools, and actually encourage kids not to sign up for the U.S. military. I'm against the expansion of U.S. imperialism. I think it's one of the greatest threats. The U.S. empire, I think, is one of the greatest threats the world faces today. But I also recognize imperialism coming out of Russia. I also recognize the attempt of the Assad regime to repress any form of dissent in 2011. Four chill teenagers were thrown in jail and tortured for writing anti-government.
This guy was tortured too. This guy right here was tortured.
Excuse me. I'm sorry about that, but please, you'll get your chance.
And people rose up through largely peaceful protests in the beginning. There were strikes. There's a whole number of real strong opposition. Because, I mean, we didn't talk too much about the last 30 years under the Assad family. But that was a totalitarian regime and instituted one of the largest security threats in the world. And I think it's not something to just breeze over. And I think a lot of people in Syria are responding to that. It's a very confusing situation. But I think if we want to build an anti-war movement in the city, we can't hinge ourselves on building it off of Assad and what is clearly a war criminal in a totalitarian state. And I think we need to call that for what it is. I'm neither for Moscow nor Washington. And I think we stand with the people of Syria who want to fight for freedom and democracy, and we don't stand for the war.
Hands off Syria, gets it on. I'll
respond. First of all, I applaud your anti-war work after your trip in Afghanistan, you know, your spell in Afghanistan, I think you've mischaracterized a couple of things. One of them is the events of 2011. We now have a number of countries where peaceful there were peaceful demonstrations. Syria is a capitalist country. It has a left and a right. It has a working class and a capitalist class. It has the normal politics of a capitalist state. The protests of 2011 were hijacked by external forces. Now, does it seem outlandish to assert that? Well, if you've been following events in the Ukraine, you had events in on the Maidan, which was the main square in Kiev, that were hijacked by the neo-Nazis, who are now in the Ukrainian government, thanks to the actions of Victoria Nuland and her supporters in the State Department. So we have to, I'm not interrupting you, and I respectfully request that you do not interrupt me. So characterizing as a totalitarian state, I mean, that's a word out of Cold War days. It is, anybody who's been to Damascus knows, when you walk around, yes, there's repression, but there's, and I'm not a defender of every aspect of repression. The negative thing that I hear the most of,
Please.
Shut up.
This entire crowd would like.
Grow up.
No.
Then leave. Then leave.
Go, David. I did not interrupt you. Nobody interrupted you.
It's irrelevant. It's completely irrelevant.
You will get a chance to speak if you don't interrupt. Otherwise, I'm not even going to call on you.
Is that going to stop us?
Probably not. But you need to let this.
Security will. Yeah, security will. I don't intend to put up with this. I don't. I do, because you gave your. I disagree with some of your points, but you gave your question respectfully, and I admire your change in attitude toward war, which I deeply respect that. But the events in Deraa, the 2011 events, if you want an account that's thorough and fair and balanced, I suggest you read the book, which is available easily from Global Research by an Australian academic named Tim Anderson, who has been to Syria many times, who is an expert on Syria, an expert on the politics of Syria, and who will tell you about the events of 2011. 2011 was the year of the Arab Spring, and around the Arab world, the initial democratic upsurge beginning in Tunisia and maybe Egypt was hijacked by right-wing forces using it for their own purposes. And those forces included the Muslim Brotherhood and the Wahhabists and all these reactionary monsters, and Israel, right? Thank you for, right. That all the, and U.S., that want to shift the politics of the Arab world and the Middle East in a further right-wing direction, so that there's more subservience and there's more accommodation to oil monopoly. So there's a different narrative that's available to you, and I urge you, since you sound like a reasonable, honest person, to look into that, because calling the politics of the Assad government, he's a bourgeois nationalist. He's he's more repressive than we would. All states repress. This is America. We have 2 million black people in the incarceration system. So who are we to say, oh yeah, we're going to invade you and overthrow you because you're repressive? So look at we need to put this in perspective. It's not.
We'll come back to it. We'll come back to it.
Thank you. That's my. Yeah.
I want to say, Joe, thanks very much for traveling to Chicago and for your talk. My name is Joe Osbaker. I'm with the Anti-War Committee here, and I'm part of the United National Anti-War Coalition as well. And I went with them, including Judy Bello, who was on your trip to Syria in the summer of 2014. We went over to observe the Syrian presidential elections.
Right.
When Haider, for example, was running against Assad.
Right.
In those elections.
Right.
And when we were there, we had the opportunity to choose which city we wanted to go to observe the elections. So I was in a group that chose to go to Homs, which the Muslim Brotherhood, called the birthplace of the revolution.
Right.
And when we got there, there's on the main strip, there's a wall with photographs of almost 1,000 martyrs who've been killed by foreign mercenaries.
Right.
I think mercenaries is a fine word to call them. And then we went to several, like four or five precincts to witness the voting process that was going on. And the voting process was, you know, not that it was not that distinct from, you know, other places. They did the thing where they dipped their finger in blue ink. But in Holmes, there were thousands of people at each precinct waiting to vote. And, you know, through interpreters, we had a chance to speak with a bunch of them. And 95% of them were going to vote for Assad.
Right.
And they were there to vote for Assad. And they all said essentially the same thing over and over and over again. These foreign armies have invaded our country, and we are standing behind our government and our army to defeat them. And our president is doing a good job, because at that point in June of 2014, the foreign backed armies were almost beaten. They were, you know, the Syrian army had the offensive. And then, you know, as we were leaving, I remember saying, well, this could be over in a couple of weeks. And 10 days after we left the country, ISIS invaded Iraq and got all those weapons and troops and turned and came back in. And here we are 2 years later and hundreds of thousands of deaths further. Anyway, I just want to say I'm really glad that your delegation went. And thank you so much for having the courage to, you know, stick your neck out up to Chicago.
Thank you. Thank you. It's kind of you.
Yeah, I just want to bring up something that I heard on, or I read on the, I think it was Global Research tonight. And that is that, well, first of all, I listened to Professor Stephen Cohen, who speaks every Tuesday night about the situation. He's a professor of Russian history. Very good. But he goes back and forth a lot from Syria and Ukraine, what's worse.
Right.
But what they mentioned on Global Research, that there was a bill passed at the in the House on September 21st, it's called the Stability and Democracy for Ukraine Act, as to send more lethal weapons and more lethal weapons into Ukraine. And now that's going to pass to the Senate. So if anybody wants it, Senator Durbin has been supporting Ukraine, sending weapons to Ukraine. I keep on writing to him. He's on a committee of some kind. I don't know exactly where he is, but I imagine it's not much better. So I just want to mention that, that we got, you know, there's these two things going on almost at the same time. It could get worse in Ukraine.
Right. I guess that's mainly a comment, but I just will say that Stephen Cohen has been doing some excellent work recently on, he's got a committee that even has some corporate support, believe it or not, called the American Committee for East-West Accord. And it's trying to reverse this new Cold War, because the Syrian-Ukrainian situation basically has Russia involved. And the neocons, who are so influential with this administration, have this obsession with Russia. And they want to push U.S. and NATO weapons to the borders of Russia. Now, suppose you're Russian, and three times in the last century, Western invaders have laid waste to your country. You are understandably a little nervous about having hair-trigger ICBMs on the border. So Cohen points this out, but it's hard to break through the irrationality of Washington, D.C. with so much neocon influence there. But he's been doing good work, and it's good to check the ACEW, the American Committee for East-West Accord, has an excellent website.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Azam Hayou. I'm Syrian. I'm liberal Syrian. I'm so sorry about my language, but well, maybe I need to some of my friends to help can translate. Firstly, I'm so sorry about what I will remind what happened in my country when I was there. Firstly, I'm one of some leaders in my city. It's Tartus at Tartu city at Zakat. So we start demonstration against Assad regime. only what talking about, just we need to change this position to, and we should to help us to cross this period. It's too hard for everybody, all the Syrian people. So I got for 4 times our regime kidnapped me for 4 times. The first time it was 8 months under the floor, 50 foot under the floor. I cannot see any light for 8 months, just because I'm liberal. I'm talking about freedom, about democracy, about human rights. Just it. We need to remove Assad regime. Just we need to talk with us about this bad situation, bad history, a bad change of power between only one. Please, anyone can would accept one president for 30 years, and he will, when he get death die, he get her, got her son the power presidency. How we can believe that in 21st century, this century?
Yeah.
I can't believe.
Bush Clinton, Clinton.
Why all the American people
do it and
elect
right.
her president? And I want to tell you about my experience in the political jail for 8 months. I whipped my bag for 2 times. All I got sick all the time for 8 months. I can't see any light. Do you know that? 5 olives and cut off bread for 1 day. I can't go to restroom. Same bottle. I have to make my water and I have to drink from same bottle. Another thing, I have to sit on the electricity chair. In my pants, penis, for 2 times. Why? I have 3 kids. I can show you my picture with my family. We are liberal completely. I don't care about religion. What happened for me, Assad regime kidnapped me for 4 times. When I left with my family, when he released me, I left my country to Lebanon. In Lebanon, Hezbollah kidnapped me again. It was the first time, my fifth time in my life. Okay. And ISIS and Muslim brothers, they sent to me a message, they will cut my neck. Same what happened with Assad regime. Do you know who's General Jamil Hassan? He made me, because he want to ask me, you are not Muslim brother, you are not communist. Who are you? Whose are you? I'm Syrian. I'm liberal Syrian. What does that mean? He don't know. The first general in his security regime, he don't know what the meaning of liberal. The first general in her regime, in Assad regime. What do you think? Just all what I need. I need to explain for everybody. I'm so sorry about our experience, but we don't need to send your American soldier to my country. We need just to know to Assad, know to ISIS, know to Iran, know to Russia. Yes, to democracy. Please, we are civilians. We are civilian people. I didn't believe before if we have to use weapons. It's for garbage. We don't need weapons. Just
thanks for sharing. We're gonna move on.
I'm so sorry about language.
Thank you.
No,
you did well. Thank you.
He is yes to a number of things, no to a number of things, not no to bombs. But he has yes to democracy, but the democracy is being delivered by bombs. Do you like bombs?
That's not.
No.
That's, here was one of the things I ask everybody to read. Again, I appreciate the passion.
Wait! This man was tortured.
I am asking everybody to be able to have a conversation.
I'm trying to moderate this.
I gave him more than twice as much time as we have, and I would like us not to cross talk because this is what happens.
Anybody that wants to make a comment is free to make a comment, but make the comment without addressing it to another person, because what happens, we will irritate people, and this is what happens. And if you enjoy that, we will do that about 8:45 downstairs. If you really enjoy that, let's not do that here, because we have a limited time with our speaker, and you all have a limited time, and I would like to maximize participation. Yes, in the back.
Yeah, of course.
So speak louder, Brian.
I'm Brian, a member of the International Socialist Organization, and I think that it's good that we started from a position opposed to U.S. intervention in any form. I think we should be opposed to the no-fly zone. I think we should be opposed to sort of all those sorts of things. I think that's the task of the anti-war movement, and that's an important one. However, I think that like part of what the presenter is talking about, to shift the perspective of the anti-war movement to sort of stop it being sort of tame and silent, I think there's a problem there. I think the problem is that I think we're not going to be able to get an anti-war movement that is able to be, you know, as robust and powerful and broad as we need to with offering soft support for someone like Bashar al-Assad. And I think that, like, while you say there's no position on the government, I think you then went through and listed a number of different positions for it. And there's a number of dods of different things. So, like, when Rory talked about the legitimate protest in the green just sort of swept the region, like hijacked by external forces. When did that happen? Where is it now? I think we need to actually a richer, more complicated understanding, because while there have been various blows to the Syrian revolution, while ISIS and groups like sort of al-Nusra Front are sort of going off and have large sort of sections of the country under control and are murdering people who have been organizing on the ground, it's also the case that at least in the spring, there were 400 to 700 local coordinating committee councils that existed that was organizing on the ground. There still exists a legitimate resistance. And to say that it is all an external attack by mercenaries, we're not going to win people to opposing war with that position, because it's not completely true. I think talking honestly about the situation, which is a f***ed up situation, and talking about a situation in which the policies of the United States government, the policies of the Russian government, and the policies of Bashar al-Assad have led to the hegemony of these grotesque groups like ISIS and al-Nusra Front. But I think that, like, we don't lend the anti-war movement any credit by giving sort of soft support for someone like that. Because, you know, it's like, when did it happen? What do we say about that? And it's like, you say when they argue for toppling the dictator as a de facto, but like when the people in the streets of the entire Middle East were sort of uttering out, you know, calling the people want the fall of the regime, like, what do we say that to the people then? Like, when did it end? I think there's a legitimate resistance that exists that we need to identify and express solidarity with, as opposed to another government who, I mean, before this, they had CIA black sites. Like, how is that an anti-imperialist government?
Thank you. Thank you. Yes, sir.
You know, there's a basic democratic principle of self-determination of the peoples, not interference by the U.S. or anyone else. And this basic democratic principle is enshrined in international law. The U.S. or any other country has no right by international law, United Nations Charter, which the U.S. has signed. The U.S. has no right to interfere in Syria or any other country unless the other country has attacked the U.S. Syria has not attacked the U.S. Other countries have not attacked the U.S., but the U.S. gives itself the right to interfere. This is not only immoral, as has been pointed out, but it's illegal by international law. And those pursuing American interference in other countries are following a path of being war criminals under the Nuremberg statutes and other ones. Whether you like Assad or don't like Assad is not the issue. That's up to the Syrian people to decide, not up to any of us to decide.
That's my position.
What is up to us to decide is to keep the U.S. out of all these countries, bring all the troops home now, create an anti-war government for no more interference in Syria or anywhere else by the U.S.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'd just like to say there's only one thing that the speaker was correct about, and that is that there's not a civil war in Syria. What there is an imperialist war of extermination against a revolutionary people. It's being waged by the government of Russia. It's being waged by the government of Iran. It's being connived with by the government of the United States, who hypocritically claim to support a revolution but don't. And what is true is that there is a real civil war being waged. And that civil war is in this room tonight. The real civil war is here in this room tonight. And that is, does the peace movement, does the anti-war movement, is it a real movement of human solidarity? Is it a movement of solidarity with those people in Syria who rise up for freedom, who continue to rise up for freedom, who die in their thousands for freedom under bombs, under torture, who refuse surrender, who refuse these stupid little deals that the speaker talked about, which, yes, if you just go back to being a slave of a totalitarian regime, then we'll more or less leave you alone until we come knocking at your door in the middle of the night again, as we have done for the last 50 years. Now, we are fighting for what kind of movement we're going to have. And it's clear to me that there's a lot of people in this room who are quite fine with what? With genocide. They're quite fine with what? With racist and Orientalist narratives of the lack of agency of Middle Eastern people. Yeah, that's the war I'm going to fight. And if you think that I'm not upset about that, you're goddamn right I'm upset, because I've spent the last 30 years of my life being a part of the left. No, we are not going back to some weird idea of Stalinism from the 1930s that some of you characters want to go back to. We will never go back. And I'm with the people of Syria. And you know what they're saying? We will never go back to what existed under the Assad regime. We're going to overthrow it. And I see people smirking here. I see Hushi, who's a friend of the Iranian regime, which crushed its own freedom movement. Okay. Look at him. He's putting his fist in the air. That's his idea of freedom, crushing a people's movement, going to another person's country and committing genocide. That's his idea of freedom. There are some people in this room that's their idea of what life should be. That's not my idea. That's not the people of Syria's idea. And guess what? As Woody Guthrie said, all you fascists are going to lose.
I listened to the discussion and the the media, and it brings me extremely close to what I saw in Central America. I went there in 1964, and I lived through several years of the oppression in Guatemala, and know the dialogue that was going on. I've lived in Nicaragua, and I've just come back from there. One of the things I wanted to say about the a government that brings in the people that, in that case, in Nicaragua's case, the Contra, and incorporates them into the government, not with complete easy passage, but that they have done that. They're already in Nicaragua, and that's the way that government runs. But the idea of regime change and the kind of the demonization and all that goes on, it's the same thing I saw there, and the thing of having the Contras come in of all sorts of mayhem that they bring in that are anti-democratic but supported by the United States. To me, it's a nauseous situation that I've seen and know of in reports from many places in the world.
Thank you.
Yeah, I just wanted to thank the speaker for hearing his observations from Syria and also the subsequent study prior and afterwards. I think it was very refreshing also to put the spotlight on the role of our own government in fomenting the strife in the Middle East. There's a tendency to buy into this narrative and to neglect the role of the U.S. empire in trying to turn the clock back to recolonize huge sections of the Middle East and beyond. And it's been done, I think, very skillfully under the slogan of humanitarian interventions. Yugoslavia, the breakup of that country, the subjugation to those, and certainly Afghanistan, Iraq, now Syria, and other regions. And you see how fairly advanced economies and civilizations, take Iraq for example, had like one of the finest school systems in the world, in the Middle East, one of the finest educational equipment. Sanitary systems, healthcare systems, have been blown to smithereens, just crushed, and that's what's going on in large parts of Syria, to me. And the heat is off the White House. The heat is off the U.S. government. But really, the architects of this whole policy of trying to overthrow and recolonize these regions, frustrate the Arab Spring, and redirect it, in the reactionary direction. This is largely orchestrated by the most powerful financial, corporate interests in the United States and the government that serves it. So Palestine, the subjugation of the Palestinian people in Gaza, West Bank, and the diaspora, it's part of a continuum of U.S. policy of dominating, trying to turn the clock back. So I would say that there is cause for worry that this, not only this one region, but also the threats to Russia, threats to China, the encirclement of China. These are really grave threats, and we need to take the speaker's word seriously.
Thank you.
I know Joe has one of the people here who's been recently to Syria, so I was wondering if you could talk more about what people have said.
What's
your opinion about what you've heard here, and what
does
any other
thing
you should know about what you saw in Syria?
Well, let me just mention, we had on our trip, besides people who had organizational bases, like Peace Council, Veterans for Peace, UNEC, we also had journalists. We had a lawyer, too, who was an expert on restorative justice. But we had a journalist, a British journalist named Vanessa Beely, and you can see her work on the internet fairly readily. But she introduced us to a Canadian journalist, and what I am sensing is that there is beginning to be some pushback in the journalistic community in coverage of the war. These two women are heroes, in my estimation. They went to Aleppo. Unlike much of the NPR or certainly corporate media reporting, which is from Beirut, which is 3 hours away and quite safe, they go to Aleppo, and they take pictures and report on things they see. One of the things that I learned from these two women in our discussions with them was the changing nature of media distortion. The empire learns. You remember back, we talked about this earlier, in the Iraq War, when we had embedded journalists. And what was that? That was a great innovation. It ensured that U.S. reporters on the war would have a military viewpoint, because they would be sharing all the social circumstances and conditions of U.S. soldiers. It produced a distortion, a fundamental distortion, in reporting on the war. And there's been some innovations since then. Smart power, one of Hillary's favorite phrases, or soft power, depends now on new forms of media manipulation. So, for example, the non-government organizations, NGOs, there is a vast array of non-governmental organizations supported by the U.S. and the U.K. government, which report only from the jihadi side of the war. There's an outfit which I heard quoted on NPR the other day, and I think I might have heard it on Democracy Now! Too, the Syrian Observatory of Human Rights, which is a colony of the Muslim Brotherhood, which is run out of London by a paid-up member of the Muslim Brotherhood. Now and U.S. reporters are taking their viewpoints and factual observations as the basis of reporting. It's worse. There's an outfit called the White Helmets, which just won an award from the Right Livelihood, which is kind of a preliminary to the Nobel Peace Prize. It may get the Nobel Peace Prize. It's funded by the U.S. and the U.K. governments, who are prosecuting the war. So, I didn't interrupt you. Got it?
But I didn't slander people who risked their lives to pull babies out of the rubble and collapse buildings.
You don't get to pass. Tell them not to.
Yeah.
If you do,
you got some courage.
Okay.
Some courage with your words.
This is just a shameful humiliating
error. So there's this huge infrastructure of non-governmental organizations, which including
people are stupid enough.
Can we call security?
You're free to do this outside, downstairs. This is a forum that's
right.
Médecins Sans Frontières, the French medical organization.
You mentioned that.
We have one over here and one over here.
I've seen any of you people show up for Syrians when they ask for all of you people. Occupy, war coalition. We ask for all of you to represent Syrians. We ask for you to represent Syrians. They did too. And you turned your face on them. That's despicable.
Ava Bartlett.
And you didn't have an organizer.
Ava Bartlett.
Right?
She and Vanessa Beale are doing
this. You've been with Syrians for years, and you people stand with your accolades and your freaking degrees.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
We're nothing.
I just wanted to know the name of the second journalist that you said we should check. What's your name?
Yeah. Ava Bartlett. Yeah. And, yes.
Both liars for the regime, by the way.
Go back to your
comment. Fact check their work.
Back to your talk about Assad.
Okay. And all you said in the whole thing was, we met with Assad, and Assad explained it to us.
Thank you.
I didn't hear any other evidence. We met with Assad, and Assad told us.
And we met with you, and you explained it
to us. He's leaving. Please.
Let him leave.
Yeah, I feel degraded. Just associating with
him.
Congratulations. Thank you.
I know it's hard.
It's a humiliation.
No, it's hard for Syrians. That's who it's hard for.
It certainly is.
While you stand here and lie off a freaking war tour.
Yeah, genocide is hard.
I hope you enjoyed that vacation you had.
Genocide is hard.
Good job, y'all.
Coming from an ethnic community.
I stood with Syrians. Remember that. When you all freaking were in your houses, formulate your lies. Formulate your lies.
So I'm over there.
I know it's difficult, but it has never worked out when you get into a cross-chatter. It never works out well. It never does. I know. It's hard. But please.
I come from an ethnic community that has always, that is of the last 80 or so, or 50 years, been in crosshairs of American imperialism, which is what I will call it. My grandparents immigrated from Greece in the turn of the previous century. In any case, I have kept up some relationships with people in Greece. And what I want to say is that at some point when I was starting hazily to become aware of things political, it was always the American government that was going after the Assad father, because they hated his independent stance, that he did not toe the United States line. And they were always going off Andrew Papandreou, who was the same way in Greece. And these guys had a lot in common because they were the few countries around the Mediterranean that were not towing the American line. And we got our junta, and they have what they, Syria now has what it has now. I mean, it's part of the system. And in that regard, I want to recommend to you all the book by Greg Grandin called Empire's Workshop, which is a recitation of how the United States rehearsed all this stuff in South America in the 70s and 80s. It's a great book.
Who's the author?
Greg Grandin, G-R-A-N-D-I-N.
I'm not going to take my full 3 minutes. I just want to give you, I want to give you something to think about. Saddam Hussein, Ho Chi Minh, Manuel Noriega, and I don't remember the president in Honduras.
Zelaya.
Each of those, to a lesser degree than Zelaya, each of those imprisoned people, tortured people, denied people human rights, are responsible for crimes against whomever. But in none of those cases did we say the U.S. should go and invade. In none of those. Yeah. So I'm just asking you to think about that. I don't support Hussein or Ho Chi Minh or Noriega or, for that matter, Zelaya, right? But when... I'm just asking you to think about that. And conversely, I would ask you to think about, do not the Egyptians also, one day, Sisi sentenced 800 people to prison in one day, in about 15 minutes. In Bahrain, when there was a mass uprising like in Syria, the U.S. didn't arm the opposition. They gave money to the king of Bahrain. End of that spring. The same thing happened in Yemen, when the Houthis opposed the a government, and it was the U.S. had a different position. I'm just asking you to think these things out a little bit broader, and then I would just end with saying that the media does this by, the techniques are very simply location, where are you reporting from, sources, who gets quoted, and then what's the frame? And the frame is humanitarian or some other threat.
Their children were dying, which they are.
In each of these cases, children were dying, which was precisely the argument that the U.S. was making. Hands off is a different thing.
Mr. Arts, can I ask you one question? You haven't mentioned RT TV. This lady brought up a point today, so she just heard it on RT TV months ago. And I watch it every morning. I get up and I watch Amy Goodman at 7 o'clock. Now, she has changed considerably in the last couple of months. But she was always very good prior to that. But Russia Today has truth coming out that you do not see anywhere else. And I'm just curious why you didn't mention it.
Well, do you want me to answer?
what I find is that among progressive people, we're all triangulating in order to get a realistic picture of the world. And that means looking at Telesur, the Venezuelan. It means looking at Al Jazeera sometimes. They've gone pretty bad on the Syrian war. There are several Russian channels. CBC on most days is better than any American. So because of the impoverishment of U.S. corporate media, reduced to sort of organized stupidity, you know, and triviality, we scramble, and we all do this. And each of us works out a kind of a technique to kind of apply a discount depending on the source. So I don't think RT does have a lot of cutting-edge international coverage, which is more honest than stuff you find on CNN or any other. But on the other hand, I always keep an eye out for their own selfish interests. I mean, Russia is an imperialist power. Now, they may be doing something legal, whereas the U.S. is doing something illegal now, but Mr. Putin represents oligarchs, ultimately. I don't think we should have any illusions about that. And
they have just like professors the there from various universities around the country who go and speak on RT.
Right.
You don't see them on other television stations.
Right.
There's many sources. There's many sources.
Consortium News is known.
I just
wanted
to ask questions rather than make comments. Now, I don't want to make personal comments except that green and white and black around the neck of a liberal, I have never seen. It's a colonial flag of Syria, and it represents the Muslim brotherhood.
No, that's bullshit. It's the revolution flag. That's just a lie. No, that's just a lie. Sorry.
My question is this: that considering that, what is the magic code about this? Assad should go, and on the other side, Assad should not go. Is there a chance of any reconciliation between, and what is the exact, well, the Assad says, okay, election is fine. Russia, which is involved in this issue, says election under strict international observers is fine. Iran says elections under, but the opposition, including the United States and Saudi, especially Saudi Arabia, which is the major financier of this whole thing, he says, no, if he has to go. What's the big deal about it? Why don't they, if there's supposed to be a cessation of this massacre going on, why don't they accept that there should be an election and there shouldn't be without a state? There can't be any election. Why don't they? Accept that there should be election. What is written on it?
Criminal
Assad must go.
A, there was an election recently, and B, the question. I think you probably agree with what is the principle of our organization, namely. Only Assyrians have a right to determine the future of Syria. That's our view. And so coming up with transition plans is part of the imperial political effort. John Kerry should not be planning transitions in Syria. That's our position. It's only Syrians who have a right to determine the future of their country. Our job is to stop the empire.
Everybody gets to talk once, and I will come back.
So, just after the U.S. accidentally bombed the Syrian army position that was guarding some significant airport, there was a Russian missile strike on some sort of intelligence center that was reportedly containing American intelligence agents and Israeli and some others, 20-some Americans, Israelis, and others were reported killed in the strike, according to Iranian news, and there was a report in a Russian source as well. You know anything about that?
I heard that same report about a subsequent Russian strike. But then I heard from Vanessa Bealey, who was writing from Damascus, there was no confirmation of that. Now, and there may have been, I haven't had a chance to keep an eye on this for the last 48 hours, but I haven't heard confirmation of that. It could be. But I think it illustrates the point of how precarious this situation is. You've got two nuclear powers, toe-to-toe, and prestige is at stake. And it's a volatile situation. Accidents can happen.
Yeah. just to follow up, was there any talk about Israel's role in destabilizing the democracy movement?
Not in Syria, not on our trip. Israel plays a role. First of all, it has an enormous influence on U.S. Foreign policy. But secondly, concretely, there have been many verified reports of Israeli support for the jihadis, giving them medical treatment over the Israel the border and then sending them back in. So and there are lots of reports about intelligence cooperation, and the Israelis have a very powerful intelligence network. So, but no direct boots on the ground, as far as I know. I have not heard any such thing.
Anybody else?
One thing. My name is Abdul. I lived in Syria most of my life. I just came here like 3.5 years ago. The reason why we can't reconcile with the state, because it's a terrorist state. They have committed crimes more than ISIS. Those are facts. Not because the U.S. media said so, but because it's actually happened.
For the U.S. I know get you guys have to protest on the U.S.
protest media,
aside.
That is biased.
They're changing the subject.
But just because they said something doesn't make it untrue. We have the massacres that are happening every day in Aleppo. There are videos that are coming up every day. We can't just ignore that. We can't just go back to the Assad regime. Assad regime has killed more civilians by bombing their areas. Right now, their areas are being bombed every day. You can't reconcile with them. How do you reconcile with them when in the last week they've killed 100 children in Aleppo alone? In the last week, and the videos are online. The videos have been uploaded by the White Helmets that he just landed.
Excuse me. No.
I don't think you ought to let him go. Are you going to let him go? Are you going to let him talk again?
No, not until you're answering this question.
Okay. I can't begin to reply because there were so many factual inaccuracies in what you said.
Name one.
As I said, I can't begin to reply because...
Name one factual inaccuracy. No, you don't get a pass. Name one.
Who decides whether I get a pass or not? No, you don't.
Yes, I do. I'm the audience here. You're the speaker. Who did you come to speak to about the audience?
It's too important for me.
Helping your cause.
Do you want to speak?
You're not helping my cause either, buddy.
A question that you aren't supporting.
We don't know what it's about.
No?
I've said that about 4 or 5 times. I don't know.
Tracking this for quite a few years. I had two friends who were teachers who had been living in Damascus for a number of years. They were running a project called the Iraqi Student Project.
So,
yes, right. Okay, Teresa and Gabe Huff.
Yes.
And they were living in Damascus, and they would come back every year and report on what was going on. And this was before the war really blew up. And they were reporting that everybody that they knew, these were the people in the shops down the street, and everybody that they knew was supporting the government at the time, okay? Now, maybe there were things going on. I wasn't aware. I knew that there were a lot of things that Assad had done. My son's pediatrician was a refugee from Syria. He had been imprisoned and tortured and escaped, so I had that to listen to. So I knew that Assad was no angel. But at the same time, I'm hearing from these friends that I trusted that everybody on the street that they were living with for many years was supportive of the government. So I feel I have a pretty broad idea now. And since then, I've been going to my own websites and getting pieces, some from RT, Veterans Today, Global Research, trying to put together. When you say that there's videos online, how do you know? I'm finding it very challenging to know who to believe anymore.
Right.
I've just saw a video about how a lot of NGOs are being used as propaganda.
Right.
And White Helmets is
right.
One
right.
In particular.
Right.
You know, so you really have to look at everything and think, where's the truth in this? You know, What's the agenda? Who's behind it? Who's funding this? You know,
right.
It's getting very challenging. At the end of the day, I'm going with people that I know personally have had experiences. You've been there. I have friends who have been there, and they're telling me what their experience living there on the streets were.
It doesn't matter if all the videos uploaded.
And that's what I'm having to go with, you know. So it's a very confusing issue. I understand the passions.
Right.
But at the end of the day, if the majority of the Syrian population is in favor of keeping that government in place, no matter what's going on, look at what was going on here with Bush. There was a huge part that didn't want that, but that was the majority, and we accepted the president.
Right. That, I just say, this question of the support, there is very widespread support for the government. It has contradictions, namely there are people in it who are opposition people who don't like this or that policy, but it is in effect a national unity government following, and while there is an external attack, the natural tendency of all people is to rally around the government and repel the invaders. So that's what's essential. So I agree with what your two friends told you. But as Professor Art said to me just now, you could overwhelm yourself with this struggle to find out who is an authentic source. I think as Americans we can agree, I think we can and should agree, that what we have to do is stop what our government is doing. That's our chief responsibility to the world. And if we have an analysis that shows that the U.S. is the main organizer of this war, and I think that's a correct analysis, and I have argued that tonight, then you shouldn't have to drive yourself crazy about worrying which video is faked and which video is authentic. Over time, and I again refer you to the Tim Anderson book, you can figure out which are the journalists who are telling the truth. There was a wonderful article today by a veteran U.S. journalist named Robert Parry, who did the Iran-Contra expose 30 years ago. It's published on Common Dreams, which is a very good website to check out. It will give you an overview of the Syrian situation, and he does understand. You have the reason I'm hopeful that we are beginning to move the boulder up Mount Everest on this is that even people who are kind of in the establishment world are beginning to shift a little bit. So, for example, this is Dr. Jeffrey Sachs, an economist who has both liberal... So he has some liberal records on environmental issues. He's got a record on Eastern Europe that I think is less than admirable, but helping to impose shock therapy on Eastern Europe. So he's got both conservative and... Anyway, he wrote a big article about a month ago questioning the whole U.S.-Syria policy. So when you get a public intellectual like that beginning to shift, then it's a sign that something's happening. So I'm hopeful that we can begin, because we're going to have to either between now and January, and certainly after January, we have to organize a much better anti-war movement.
I just want us to think. Hussein was a dictator. Hussein killed people en masse. He gassed his people. But when the U.S. went in, we didn't say, oh, the U.S. is there for humanitarian reasons. Look what happened with the U.S. going into Iraq. You don't have to defend Assad. Everything you said is true. That's true. The upload's true. What's the question? Hands off Syria. U.S. out of Syria. That's what happened. That's what happened.
Does that go for Russia and Iran?
Everybody hands off Syria, yes. That's simple.
You
I would ask you all to, I would just repeat, the U.S. Peace Council has a website. You can find it. The U.S. Peace Council has a YouTube site. There's plenty of YouTube sites to present the young man's point of view. I would encourage all of you to look, and I would also encourage all of you to think very hard about U.S. foreign policy. Thank you for coming. Thank you all for coming. Thanks for the organizers, Stan, the Anti-War Coalition, and the U.S. Peace Council. Thank you. Thank you very much.